Hello everyone, welcome back to the Shark Snippets podcast, the bite-sized podcast for anyone who loves or wants to learn about sharks, skates and rays. My name is Josh and I'm a marine biologist who specialises in shark ecology. So let's get straight into the first snippet, Species of the Week. So, this week I'm going to tell you some interesting facts about the big-eyed thresher shark. There are three different species or types of thresher shark, all known for their long, whip-like tails that can account for up to half of their total length. However, the big-eyed thresher shark is easily distinguishable from its other relatives by a couple of key features. The first feature is where the species derives its name from, its big eyes. It has the biggest eyes compared to all of the other thresher sharks, and interestingly, their eyes are also directed upwards. The second feature is that they have deep grooves on their heads, giving them a distinct shape compared to the other thresher sharks. The big-eyed thresher can grow up to 4.88 metres or 16 foot, with their average size being 3.35 to 4 metres or 11 to 13 foot. The heaviest recorded big eye is 363.8 kilos or 759.8 pounds. With their average weight being around 160 kilos or 350 pounds. The female big-eyed threshers reach maturity between 11 and 12 years old, whilst males are between 9 and 10 years old. The big-eyed thresher is found in coastal waters over the continental shelves in all of the world's oceans, except the Arctic and Southern Ocean. They are known to live inshore and on the high seas, in the epipelagic zone, as well as at the depths of the intercontinental slopes. The epipelagic zone is the area of the ocean that stretches from the surface down to 200 metres. Their main depth range is from the surface to 500 metres, or 1,640 foot. However, the deepest recorded depth for a big-eyed thresher is 723 metres or 2,372 foot, which is exceptionally deep. The most distinctive characteristic of the big-eyed thresher and the other thresher sharks is their unusually long tail. Whilst there are no known recordings of big-eyed threshers using their tails for anything other than swimming, it is believed that they use it to stun their prey by quickly moving their tails in a whipping motion and then going on to swallow up the stunned fish or squid. Their big eyes, from where the species gets its name from, are shaped like an upside-down pear and have a vertical height of 4 inches or 10 centimetres. This makes them proportionally the largest eyes of any non-avian or non-bird vertebrae. Their large upward-facing eyes are believed to help them absorb as much downwelling or down-facing light to identify prey in the deep, dark depths. The thresher shark is part of the mackerel shark order, and shares a unique adaptation with some of the other species found in the order, such as the great white and the mako. This adaptation is being partially warm-blooded. The majority of animals grouped under the title of fish, including sharks, are cold-blooded or ectothermic. However, a few species have the capability to maintain their body temperature 2 to 4 degrees Celsius or 3 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the water in which they swim. The big-eyed thresher shark is one of these species, and it's believed to give them the ability to swim and hunt in the cold depths of the open ocean. The big-eyed thresher is listed as vulnerable on the IUCN Red List. Whilst they are not a commercially targeted species, their populations are in decline. They are often caught as bycatch in longline fisheries such as the tuna and swordfish fisheries, and also in purse or seine nets, which target schooling fish, which is one of their prey. Unfortunately, like other species of thresher sharks, there is a lack of scientific data on them. For the big-eyed thresher shark, this is mainly due to their elusive behaviour and the deep depths they inhabit. There are no known locations where you can regularly see big-eyed thresher sharks. However, you can dive with the pelagic thresher shark in Malapascal Island off of Cebu in the Philippines. Here they can be observed visiting the cleaning stations to be tended to by the brave cleaner fish. Malapascal is certainly high on my dream diving destination list to see this awesome species of shark. So, this week's Sharks in the News theme is all about shark deterrence. The first article is titled, "The Smell of Dead Sharks, Helping to Keep Surfers Safe from Attack." And the article is on wired.co.uk. The article starts out with the story of a British fisherman who was bitten at the start of last month by a port beagle shark that was caught as bycatch on his fishing vessel. The introduction is spun nicely, stating the attack wasn't a mauling by a predator, but more of a survival attempt by a trapped and desperate animal. Following this, there are some estimates of how many sharks are killed by humans, including the article stating 11,417 sharks are killed per hour by humans worldwide. A hard estimate to calculate, but along the lines of what I regularly see being circulated. The article then slightly delves into the shark cull that I've previously mentioned on this podcast series to give the reason why UK native Colin Brooker sold up his business, remortgaged his house, and went all in to find a way for humans and sharks to coexist in harmony. The article explains how Brooker was aggravated at the authorities in Australia for the shark cull, and believe that there must be a better way of resolving the conflict between humans and sharks. This led Brooker to develop Podi, a device that can be attached to a surfboard or worn by a person. The idea is that Podi slowly releases a chemical based on the scent of a dead shark. The chemical continually dissolves in the water to provide a potent, potentially life-saving repellent. So why the scent of dead sharks? The article states that Brooker began with the assumption that, like every other animal, a shark could be persuaded to flee from a situation under self-preservation. Brooker states in the article that sharks aren't generally cannibalistic, which is actually not the case. Many shark species are known to prey on other shark species and can form a large contribution to some species' diets. The use of dead sharks as a repellent is not a new method. As the article states, fishermen in the Indian Ocean have been towing dead sharks behind their boats to protect their fishing catch for hundreds of years. However, not wanting to kill sharks for protection, Brooker sought to mimic the scent through chemically mining components that could create the required off-putting scent. Through Cat's Eye, a pharmaceutical company, six potential chemicals were identified and then tested in Fishhook Bay in South Africa. Now, I think there might be an error in the article here, as there is a fish hook in South Africa. However, it is not a bay. And the article states there is a natural funnel where juvenile bull sharks would swim. And unfortunately, bull sharks are not found in the fish hook in South Africa. Therefore, I think the article has misidentified the location and is meaning Fishhook Bay off of the coast of Perth. Nonetheless, the trial, wherever it took place, was successful in determining the best chemical. 4 years in and £250,000 of Brooker's own money later, they are now beginning to investigate the optimum dosage, rate of dispersion and delivery method. Brooker believes Pody could have huge implications for coastal defence, search and rescue and national shark policies. He is now working with the Reunion Shark Risk Management Centre, which is a joint enterprise between the French government and the government of Reunion. For those that don't know, the island of Reunion was responsible for 16% of the world's shark attacks between 2011 and 2016, and has had a severe impact on the tourism there. The article states that the Reunion Shark Risk Management Centre will be independently testing Pody alongside other potential solutions. Brooker believes that Pody is around 18 months from completion. It has still not been scientifically tested though, and in my opinion needs much more tested before it can be confirmed as a viable shark repellent. So, the next article is titled, Shark Deterrent Tech Says It's the Only Proven Solution That Works 60% of the Time. The article discusses the reaction of one of the shark deterrent brands that was involved in a recent scientific study that was commissioned by the New South Wales Department of Primary Industries. The study was undertaken by Charlie Hooveniers of Flinders University, with the intention to scientifically test the most popular shark repellents on white sharks. I'm only going to go briefly into the article because the Sharks in Science snippet will delve further into the report and its findings. The article states the different types of shark repellents, such as surf waxes, wristbands and leashes, and that only one repellent showed a significant effect in the study, whilst all others showed virtually none. The part of the article which I really like and wanted to share with you is the cited statement by Chris Lowe, who runs the California State University Shark Lab. He states, "My concern is that people will think they're invincible and will actually engage in behaviour that is more riskier than what they normally might do." I think this is an extremely valuable thing to remember. Just by wearing or using a device or product can give people a false sense of security, which is something that certainly needs to be avoided. There is a nice little video snippet showing Chris Lowe from the article, and I will link that in the description of the episode for you guys to watch. As with both of the articles, I will also link their web addresses if you guys want to check them out. Now for the Sharks in Science snippet, where I can discuss in depth the results and findings of the shark repellent study. In the previous episodes, I have mentioned how the amount of shark and human interactions and shark bites per capita in Australia has increased over the last few years. This has led to an increased amount of shark repellents being developed and commercially sold. However, many of these products have not been scientifically tested and could potentially be providing an exaggerated sense of security to members of the public using them. Additionally, some of these devices or deterrents can be quite expensive. The study tested five different shark deterrents that have been developed specifically for surfers. They include the Freedom Plus Surf, which is an electrical system that emits an electrical impulse through the electrode stickers on the bottom of the surfboard. And the electronics are incorporated in the tail kick of the back grip. Then there is the Repeller or R-Peller, which is also an electrical system that emits an electrical impulse. However, both the electrode and electronics are built into the same unit and attached to the bottom of the surfboard. Then you have the Shark Bands bracelet, which is a magnetic bracelet that is worn on the wrist or ankle of a surfer. And by the same company, the Shark Bands surf leash, which is the same magnetic technology as the bracelet. However, it's incorporated into a surfboard leash. And finally, the Chillax wax, which is just like regular surfing wax, but contains an odour that sharks supposedly dislike. And just like regular surfing wax, it's just applied to the top of a surfboard. Both the electrical and magnetic repellents are designed to impact the electroreception sense of sharks, something that I briefly discussed in the Great Hammerhead section in episode 1. In addition to the five repellents, there was also a control, or dummy surfboard, that had all of the different deterrents attached to it, but not giving out any of the electrical, magnetic, or smell repellents. This control is just to prove that the repellent is what's causing the potential difference in behaviour of a shark. So for the experiment, each different repellent had and the control had its or was attached to its own surfboard, and then around 2 kilos of fresh tuna gills, which is referred to as bait, were attached 30 centimetres below the board to replicate the typical distance between a surfer's foot and their board when a surfer is sitting on the board waiting for a wave. Great white sharks were the chosen shark species to test the deterrents on, as great white sharks are responsible for 19.5% of all shark bites and 30% of all fatalities in Australia, which is the highest for any species. The five shark deterrents were tested by comparing the percentage of baits taken, the time taken for the bait to be taken by the shark, the number of passes, the distance between the shark and the bait, and whether a shark reaction could be observed. 50 individual trials for each repellent and the control were aimed for, and a total of 297 successful trials were completed at the Neptune Island Group Marine Park. During these trials, 44 different white sharks interacted with bait, making a total of 1,413 passes. The effectiveness of deterrence was variable, with the Freedom Plus Surf affecting shark behaviour the most, with an increased number of reactions and reducing the percentage of bait taken from 96%, which was the control board, to 40%. This led to an increase in the number of passes because exposed sharks continue to attempt to take the bait. But the mean distance from a shark to the board increased from 1.6 metres with the control board to 2.6 metres with the Freedom Plus Surf being active. But the time it took to interact with the bait remained indistinguishable. All the other deterrents had limited or no measurable effect on the white sharks. There are some great infographics within the published report, and as always, the link for the report will be in the description of the episode. So, to sum up the project, it's quite clear that the majority of these shark deterrents don't have any impact with white sharks. And even the one that did, the Freedom Plus Surf, still only reduces the potential impact. I certainly hope that companies selling shark repellents are not fully aware that their products are not effective, and that they will consider these findings to assess their products and ensure that the repellents perform as intended. Additionally, consumers need more testing, specifically by independent bodies or scientists like this study, to really confirm the impact these sharks' deterrents have, and specifically on the species of sharks that are known to interact with humans or provide a larger threat, such as white sharks, tiger sharks, or bull sharks. The last thing that anyone wants to see is an altercation between a shark and a surfer where they thought they were protected using a shark deterrent device. If you have bought or are considering buying a deterrent, please be aware that some of them may not work as advertised, and if they do work, then they only reduce the risk and not eradicate it. Well, guys, thank you very much for listening. As always, I would love to hear your thoughts and feedback on the episode, and I would love to hear from you guys, particularly if you have a species of ray or skate that you would like to know more about. If you do, let me know on Twitter or via an email. The links are in the podcast description. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you all have a jawsome week. Hello, welcome back for another episode of the Shark Snippets podcast, the bite-sized podcast for anyone who loves or wants to learn about sharks, skates, and rays. My name is Josh, and I'm a marine biologist who specializes in shark ecology.